Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State and beyond. Today, we're talking to Liam Hutchison, a young birder from Washington. How's it going, Liam?
It's going great. Thank you. How are you guys
Yeah.
doing?
Doing well. We got that 2 hour time difference. So it's 9:10 here, and it's still light by you, which is cool to see. But
Yeah.
you recently broke the Washington big year record. So tell us a little bit about how, well, I guess first how you got into birding and then how you kind of set your sights on that record.
Yeah, sure. So, I kind of got into birding at a really young age. I was probably about six, seven, somewhere around there. I don't really quite remember like the exact age I started with it. And I've always had a really kind of fascination with nature and the outdoors and all that. We used to go pick mushrooms and stuff. I was really into big predators like cats and wolves and stuff when I was really young. So we kind of foolishly go out looking for mountain lions and stuff, which doesn't usually really work anyways. And it's kind of a dumb idea to begin with. So of course we never saw anything. But I kind of got sick of that, and I, like we're not seeing any mountain lions. This is what are we doing? And I kind of somehow moved my attention over to birds, and since then it's just kind of been a snowball downhill. Went on my first CBC that year, went on my first pelagic a few years later, and here we are.
And how old are you now, Liam?
I'm 16.
Awesome.
The life could have been a lot different had you seen a mountain lion back then, it sounds like.
I probably would have still ended up somewhere close to where I am, but yeah, potentially. I still haven't seen one.
Was there a bird that kind of kicked it off for you? Like one that stood out in your mind as like, I want to see more of this kind of stuff when you saw it, a spark bird, basically?
When I first started, I'd say like the first thing that really got me paying attention to birds was the Anna's hummingbirds, which were just really fun to see. And they're flashy. They sit on the windowsill at the feeder. They're hard to miss. That's me kind of got me looking at birds. And then as I kind of got more into it, I remember a Western Tanager landed in our apple tree once. And that's, I think, what really kicked me off.
I feel like that's a classic one. I feel like other people in the West have said the same. They saw a Western Tanager and then boom, they were hooked. I feel like, what do you think it is by us, Derek? Scarlet Tanagers and Cardinals usually.
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough one because there's so many migrants that come through. I mean, Cardinals like a big favorite around here. I know you guys don't get to partake in the Cardinal action.
Yeah, I feel envious about the Cardinal right now.
Yeah, we occasionally get a cardinal in Washington, but it always is chalked up to some sort of escapee or something. It's never worth
That's just
going
hilarious. I love
into.
hearing that.
So once you kind of got started into birding, how did you learn more to the point where you could do something like a state big year?
Yeah, so I had a lot of people help me along the way. And my mom was lucky enough to know one of our best birders in Washington, probably one of the better birders on the West Coast, definitely pretty far up there, who is Bill Twite, who's currently eBird reviewer for Washington State. He's been working with the Westport Seabirds Pelagics for a long time now. And he took me on my first Christmas bird count in Olympia, where I live. And he's kind of been helping me out with any questions and stuff since then. And in the past 3 or 4 years, I've had a ton of help. From others like Bill, just in the birding community. It's too many names to name. But yeah, it's been a huge group effort, and I'm really grateful for it.
Sweet. Yeah, I feel like having some kind of mentor right as you start is definitely beneficial. Otherwise, you're just kind of out there. You like me and Ryan got started, we kind of were just looking through the field guide and we'd go out and be like, why isn't this here? Why isn't this species here? Like it says it should be this time of year. So having someone be like, no, you got to go to this place to see that is really useful. And we kind of gained that along the way as well. Did you feel like there was a big learning curve when you started? Or was with that mentorship, was it kind of just you were able to catch on right away?
I don't think there was really any sort of a huge learning curve. It all seemed like it virtually. Yeah, I mean, I've been learning a ton. I still am. There's, people teach me new stuff about my backyard birds every day, and I'm always like, wow, I didn't know that. So it's never stop learning.
So I want to hear a little bit more about what is birding like in Washington, because I feel like the West Coast, The West Coast is very different than the East side of the country because we kind of feel like the East side of the country is pretty uniform in terms of, for the most part, the same stuff you get in Virginia, you'll get in Wisconsin, you'll get in Indiana. The West has that mountain range that goes right through it with the Rockies. So what is it like birding out there? Is it tricky? Is it interesting? You know, what kind of species do you get out there that are the go-to species to get?
It's really, really interesting. It's fascinating to be able to go from, 8 to 10,000 feet in elevation to sea level in a span of hours. and if you do a little bit of hiking, you can do that here. So that's really amazing. Washington, we have mountain ranges. We have the Olympics, which are kind of on the northwest coast on the Olympic Peninsula, and we have the Cascades cutting through the center. And then we have a little bit of kind of the I guess kind of an offshoot of the Rockies in the northeast part of the state called the Selkirks. And then so kind of in between the Cascades, which cut down the middle, and the Idaho border, it's a lot of arid desert and sagebrush lands. So everything from like sagebrush sparrows, and we even occasionally get black-throated sparrows, although that's rare. All those grassland species that you kind of associate with western sagebrush can be found in Washington. Sagebrushers, all the bluebirds, grasshopper sparrows, burrowing owls. And then once you cross the Cascades going west, it's just like the flip of a switch. Greenery and evergreen forests and riparian. Well, actually not a lot of riparian, but just like really green. Chestnut-backed chickadees, crossbills. Yeah, it's really different.
Yeah,
And
for
then you
sure.
have the
That's what
ocean.
we noticed when we were in Oregon and California, because we've never heard of Washington, but Oregon and California are kind of in the same vein, of course, is it's so much about elevation. You know, it's like the stuff that you get in the lowlands is going to be drastically different than the stuff that you get when you're at the tops of the mountain or even near the tops of the mountain. So that's definitely something way different about birding in the West than it is about birding in the East, probably in other places other than the Appalachian Mountains or Appalachian, depending on how you say it. So what would you say, like, if we could get a top five birds that people would come to Washington for, what would you say those would be?
It's tough to give like a top five. Like from a listing perspective, there's so many things. But those are going to be different than like, I want to come to Washington, see some cool stuff. From like a listing perspective, you can get a lot of stuff in Washington that is difficult in a lot of parts of the lower 48. And a lot of just coastal stuff. Like if you want a lower 48 parakeet auklet, you're gonna be taking a March pelagic out of Washington. Or if you want oh boy. We got free-toed woodpeckers all over the northern part of the state, which is super, super cool. And obviously those are kind of all over the northern US in places, but I really enjoy them. And just that mixture with all those mountain species and northern species, with all the western species, the western grassland desert species, all the mountain species. We have ptarmigan, which is super fun, and getting more difficult in other parts of the lower 48, whereas in Washington, we just seem to be finding new ptarmigan all the time. And then all the ocean stuff. So, yeah, it's like I couldn't really give you the top five. I have certain things that I really enjoy in Washington, bird-wise, species-wise. But for somebody that they were just visiting Washington, it'd be pretty hard to just go after five. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how you managed doing your big year while being so young. Are you homeschooled or no?
I'm not homeschooled, which definitely complicated things, but I had pretty supportive teachers, which I probably could not have done a big year without. I'm not sure they completely understood, but I'm not sure all of them were completely supportive, but most of them were pretty okay with it. And it's kind of like, if I do well enough in school, then I was at a big school. I'm not the center of attention, so just stay out of the spotlight and they probably won't care. I've birded with my mom a lot. So I relied on her for a lot of transportation, but also just the general birding community in Washington was really instrumental in getting me places that I needed to be. And I could not have done it without the other my fellow birders in Washington.
How many days of school do you think you missed?
I'm sure it's written down somewhere, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
That means it was a lot.
Double digits for sure. Yes.
Gotcha. Well, I'm sure the memory you made looking for the bird that day is gonna would stick with you more than whatever you were learning in school, probably.
Yeah, and probably, to be fair, more valuable than geometry or whatever. I don't know. We'll see. I guess we'll find out.
There's gonna come a time when you're looking for a rare bird and you need to do a 30, 60, 90 triangle. You'd be like, oh, I missed the lesson for this. Did you decide before the year started you were going to do that? Or was it just like, I'm having a fantastic year, let's do a big year this year?
Definitely the latter. I kind of started like kind of having almost a big year mindset, probably mid-February, early February, something like that. Kind of like keep your options open and like, yeah, we'll chase the rarities and the stuff that's showing up. It's not a ton of stuff, but I'm not making a special trip to Northeast Corner for the winter specialties that I can get next winter if I need to. And that definitely actually kind of bit me in the butt at the end a little bit, but it obviously turned out okay. And then probably March, mid-March is when I really started going after it.
Yeah, can you tell us what your total was and then what was the previous record?
Yeah, so our previous record was 376, set in 2021 by Will Brooks, who's another youngish birder who recently moved out east. But he did really well, and it was really amazing. And I think opened a lot of eyes to the possibility of a really high Washington State big year, because he beat the record by like six or seven, and it was a substantial year. And then the year after 2022, Brian Pendleton and Darshell Worley, who are some other Washington State birders, went out and tied Will's record, which was really interesting. And I got to go with them on a lot of trips and stuff that year. And they were actually really helpful in my big year as well. So year after 2023, I just kind of set out and did my thing and got 378. So I
Sweet.
beat it by two. Yeah.
Yeah,
It
of
wasn't another
course.
tie.
What was that, Rye?
So it's good that it wasn't another tie. You wouldn't want a four-way, three-year tie for the big year
Yeah.
record.
Yeah, that would have been really unpleasant. I was a little worried about that for a while because I kind of had a little sheet going where I was tracking all my stuff. And for a while, it was coming out right at 376. So if some stuff didn't start showing up soon, we might have some trouble. But thankfully, that didn't happen.
Did anything happen afterward in terms of accolades or anything? I know it doesn't really seem like that in Wisconsin, but it would be cool if they gave you, some news coverage or, something for your achievement. Did anything like that happen?
Like a plaque.
Yeah, like a plaque or, a certificate or something. Like, hey, you didn't tie the record, you actually beat it.
Nothing really physical like that, which is totally fine with me. I did a little bit of writing about it for some local stuff. My school gave me a shout out for it, which was nice. But nothing crazy. It's bird watching. It's not, it's not very mainstream.
It's not
You have to.
geometry.
Well, right. Yeah, I'm fine with it like that.
Yeah, I think it would be cool. Ryan, maybe we should start doing that, start giving out plaques for the year record holders for each state. That'd be pretty
For each
cool.
state, you want to send out 50 of them each year, or only when someone breaks the record?
Only when someone breaks the record. I think
Like
that'd be
people
pretty
that haven't
cool.
even heard of our channel just receive a plaque in the mail and they're like, what is this for?
How'd you get my address? But yeah,
Yeah.
be like, oh, I got a plaque for this. That'd be
That
cool.
raises some questions for sure, but I like where your head's at.
Yeah. So you mentioned all the pelagic stuff out there. How instrumental were all the pelagic trips to you getting the record?
Oh, I would have missed the record by 10 or 15 birds. Getting that far offshore is like an automatic, like your first pelagic of the year is like 15 year birds every year. And like probably a good half of those 15 year birds you're never not ever going to see again in Washington unless you're on a pelagic. So, and then of course as the year goes on, you add new stuff and new stuff and new stuff. But trying to think, I think I had two shearwater species from shore last year in Washington compared to, I want to say, five or six on the year total. No albatrosses from shore, free on pelagics. I definitely had a few alcids that were only pelagic birds. Yeah, it's impossible without a few pelagics.
So Ryan and I have never done a pelagic. We're hopefully going to be doing our first one this year. Can you give us just a kind of an overview of like what it's like? Is it kind of you're rocking on a boat the whole time and people are throwing up around you? There's like fish guts, or is it more chill? We don't really know what to expect. So can you give us a
So,
little like preview?
yeah, ho hopefully it's not, hopefully nobody's throwing up too much. There's always, it seems like there's one vomiter, but it's usually not too bad.
You don't want to
But
be that
yeah,
guy.
you don't
Eric's
want
gonna
to
be
be
the
that guy.
vomiter.
Right, right.
I'm the one that's been on boats. You have not been out on the sea in boats yet.
Oh boy.
I might vomit, maybe chum in the kitty wake or something. I don't
We did have somebody actually hit an albatross with vomit once, which was
Oh
really
man.
interesting.
I'm not on your big year though. That was
No, it was on my big year.
Oh,
It was
was
on
I
one of
in
the
big
trips I
year?
was in, yeah.
Where you just like count it.
I don't know, that was
Can you
interesting. But yeah,
imagine the photo of that? A guy vomiting just on an albatross.
I wish that I hadn't looked away.
That's some Nat Geo type stuff right there. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Seems like I'm just fine with being once in a lifetime. But yeah, maybe the albatross liked it. I don't know. They eat just about anything. They usually throw little bits of lard and fish oil at them and stuff. They love that stuff. So I don't know. But yeah, so you'll be getting to the docks pretty early, about, well, in July probably. I can't remember the exact times, but a little bit earlier than 6 a.m. probably, or a little later, depending on if it's a 6 or a 6:30 departure. I can't remember if they ever do any 5:30s. I don't think so. But yeah, so you're getting there pretty early, a little bit pre-dawn. You guys will head out. It'll be about 2, 3 hours to offshore waters where you'll really start birding on the way out. You'll get a lot of shearwaters and stuff, but you won't usually see like the first albatross until you're 30 miles, 25, 30 miles out, something like that. I don't know the exact numbers. It's just a long day. You get back at like 3:30. But your crew is really, really good. Captain is really, really good. So you'll be in good hands for sure.
Cool. Yeah, I'm really excited to start seeing some of that stuff, because even the shear waters, we haven't seen any of those.
Right.
So we're
Yeah.
pretty pumped about it.
Yeah, he's
Yeah,
been
it's
talking
fun.
about pelagics for years now, so he's been wanting to do one for a
I've
long time.
definitely been the one that's like, Ryan, we need to do a pelagic. He's like, man, I don't know. I just
Like, you're
because
not going to get great videos of anything, I don't think. There's going to be a lot of pitching and tossing.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever tried for videos on pelagics. I've tried for recordings a few times, but it's really tough with the diesel engines right behind you. Was it Michigan or Wisconsin that had a short-tailed shearwater this year on the lakes?
I don't think it was us.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
I
thought
mean,
I
if it
saw
wasn't Chase
something
Building,
about
I've
that.
heard.
Definitely, yeah, I thought I saw something about that. It was like a short tail or something ridiculous. Or actually, I can't remember if that was on one of the lakes or actually like East Coast coast. But it was something crazy like that.
It was
Some
somewhere.
somewhere
Not
over
made a
on the east.
difference. We do get Jaegers out on the lakes, though. So every year
Oh,
we
very
get
cool.
some parasitic, and then usually a couple Pomeranian or long-tailed Jaegers. So there are some birds like that on the
Okay.
Great Lakes.
Yeah, very cool.
Have you done a lot of birding out of state too, or is it mostly just been Washington?
I haven't really. It's been I really need to get out of Washington. It's getting to the point where it's like, yeah, okay, it's another Chesapeake chickadee or golden crowned sparrow. That's great, but yeah, I want to see some new stuff. I last year on my big year, I did manage to go to Arizona in the summer for about 2 weeks, which was really fun. My second time in Arizona, cleaned up a lot of stuff I'd missed the first time. I went with the Camp Chiricahua folks, which was definitely a unique experience, which I would have to highly recommend. It was really good. I don't think I'll do it again, but if it's like your first time in Arizona, for sure. That was really fun. And
Did
then
anything,
in
oh, sorry, I was gonna ask, did anything show up while you were in Arizona that you needed for your big year where you were like, oh man.
I got really lucky and nothing happened. I
Nice.
was kind of waking up every day and praying that nothing was going to happen. For once, hoping there was not going to be a rarity, which really felt wrong, but whatever. I'd also managed a trip to Texas for 3 or 4 days that I did with another Washington birder, Jason Vasallo. to go see the model owl, the Picard, all the crazy Texas stuff that was popping up. I got to visit Ryan Rodriguez, who I understand was a recent guest on your show, which was really nice since we talked some, but I never met in person. And the world of young burgers is small. So it was really fun. We got I think we got like 199 or 200 on the dot, and really free full days of birding and a four for like half day. So that was really, really good. We had a good time doing that. But other than that, it was just Washington.
Ryan's awesome. He's great at finding stuff down in Texas for sure. It was funny because we just ran into him one day when we were down there, and we're like, "Oh, you want to come look for hook-billed kites with us?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And then he just kept popping up, and became friends with him, which is a really nice resource to have down in Texas. But you definitely need to get out east
Oh,
sometime
for
and
sure.
get stuff at like the eastern warblers and all that stuff during migration that you probably don't get in the west.
I have a scary number of eastern warblers for Washington State. I it's like one of my biggest points of pride is having never missed an eastern warbler that I've chased. But yeah, I'm missing a ton of them still. I'd really like to get out east. I don't have any of the like kind of regular eastern birds like brown thrasher and stuff. I mean, I only have cardinal from Arizona, Texas, which is ridiculous. So yeah, I'd really like to get out that way.
Yeah, that's what's nice about visiting a different region is that it's, you don't have to grind to find new birds anymore. It's just like you walk outside and they're right there. So it's always nice to get easy lifers instead of the difficult, it flew halfway across the country and now it's skulking in the underbrush brown thrasher sort of lifer.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Do you currently have a nemesis bird?
Yeah. Oh boy, yes, Tufted Duck.
Ah.
I've chased Tufted Duck. Tufted Duck is the exact opposite of all my eastern warblers. I've chased it 5 or 6 times in Washington now, and missed as far as like 6 hours away, one way, and I've missed it every time. And I've had, I think my hybrid Tufted Duck count is up to three individuals now, so I've seen three hybrid Tufted Ducks and zero countable Tufted Ducks. And they're like, I haven't looked at the actual data yet. I need to like dig into eBird some when it's down from its maintenance period or whatever it's on now that they're doing. I think they've really declined as a vagrant on the West Coast. Because we just are not getting Tufted Ducks like we used to. Not that that's an excuse, but it makes me feel a little bit better.
I feel like hybrid things are just so frustrating because we ran into that looking for the tropical perulas down in South Texas. We're like, man, I hope it's not a hybrid. And then it's like, well, who actually knows how much regular northern perula DNA they have? Because some people think all of the trops down there have some northern. Others are like, well, they're probably pure enough. So it just whenever you have to start, when species are so similar, you have to worry about hybrids and genetic stuff. It takes a little bit of the fun out of it.
Gotta get the
For sure.
DNA.
Yeah, I gotta do the DNA test.
Yeah, the perulas are a real mess down there. I was also kind of like, well, what do you mean that's not a tropical perula? Look at it. Well, it's got one yellow feather. Okay. That's not good enough. That's it.
Yeah.
It's not good
Right? Yeah.
enough.
Yeah.
I feel like there's people too that just want to poke the hybrid hole and stuff too. So like they see people getting a bird, they're like, nope, it's a hybrid. Can't count it.
For sure. Those guys are out there. Yeah. I've also noticed that.
You mentioned the mountain lion stuff, but Washington, Oregon is big for Sasquatches. Have you ever had any sketchy Sasquatch encounters out in the field?
Dude, not yet. I'm just waiting. Yeah, for sure. It'll happen eventually, I'm sure. No
Are
wonder
you a
for it.
believer? Like, do you think they're out there? Or you think
Oh,
it's all just.
you gotta believe. Yeah,
It's.
absolutely.
I like it.
I do feel like I have to say that out here, people are like, oh, Sasquatch, who knows, whatever. Out in California, people were very sure that they were real because
Oh
we went
yeah, I
to
mean,
one of the places where it's a known location. People reported them and people, they were like, yeah, of course they're real. Of course I've seen one. Of course this, there's evidence.
Sasquatch
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Oregon
but
yeah,
was much more like, it was like, yeah, Sasquatch, yeah, like it's around. But California, they're like, no, they're here. Like, don't mess
yeah.
with them.
I'm not quite that into it as California people are, but yeah, I mean, when you look at our forests and stuff, they're big. I spend enough time in them looking for things like spotted owl and stuff that, oh yeah, there's some serious forest out there.
I can't wait to see your Instagram post about seeing a Sasquatch. Like, it's just
Can
gonna be like, today is the day it finally happened.
Yeah. We'll see.
Speaking of your Instagram real quick, you got a lot of cool photos that you took out in the field. What's your camera setup?
Yeah, so I just recently upgraded something that I was seeing more and more and more people using, and I kind of just bit the bullet and got an R5, which was a
Oh,
big
nice.
investment, but it definitely worth it. I mean,
Yeah, it looks awesome.
hands down worth it. And I'm using one of the I was using a Canon 100 to 400 lens with an adapter on it for a while to attach to the RF mount on the R5, but I switched over to RF lens sometime over the summer, which has been really nice. So I'm at a 100 to 500 Canon RF lens.
Sweet. I mean, like the pictures look awesome. Look at this seed eater.
Yeah,
Me
I
and
wish I
Ryan are
could change
big
theater
seed
pick.
eater fans, and people can follow you at Liam Hutchison Wildlife on there too. They want to see some of your pics, right? Yeah, the I'm pretty jealous of your pygmy owl. That was one we tried for in California and couldn't see.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, if you guys are ever out here, I'll get you a pygmy owl. That's no problem.
That's what I like to
So funny.
hear.
You don't see any
My hands
reason
are
why we
everywhere.
shouldn't go out there.
Yeah, the pygmy owls are actually really weird out here. It's weird. They almost feel localized. It's like I can go to some patches of forest and call for pygmy owl and get nothing. And then I remember last year I was up in the Olympics, at a spotted owl site, and I hooted for pygmy owl and got like four individuals, which is crazy. Like all in the same spot. Like what are they all doing there? But other places there's just none, or other places there's one, and yeah, it's kind of weird. The pygmy owls are odd.
What's the spotted owl situation like out there? Because we did a video recently on the plan or proposal to shoot barred owls. Can you get spotted owls out there? Is it really difficult? What's the situation like?
Yeah, you're not gonna get a spotted owl in Washington. probably not in Oregon. I couldn't give you the exact number, but it's probably less than 100 in Washington, and almost no reproduction, almost all singles, almost no pairs, and they're all kind of at the highest point of suitable habitat now. They've kind of just been driven up the canyons and up the ravines and up the mountains. The one I had last year for my big year was on a it was in this old growth slope in the Olympics that was like almost vertical, like legit cliffs in between the trees. It's like, well, they've just been driven up into those kinds of places that are borderline inaccessible. So, and yeah, give it another couple of decades, and I mean, they live a long time. Like we've had spot owls in Washington have lived 20 years, that were like banded in the 90s and refound in the 2000s, like 2015, something like that. So they live a long time, so it'll be a while until they're totally gone, but it's not like they're making any more. So yeah, it's really bleak.
Is that because of the habitat loss, or is that because of the barred owls?
Well, it's all driven by forest practices. But the barred owls are what are really sealing the deal. When most of our old growth logging ended, if you had kept that spotted owl population where it is, and it was the same as it was then now, like if like there what's the best way to say this? There is more than enough habitat to support self-sustaining spotted owl populations in Washington. There's plenty. I mean, there's not a lot, but there's plenty. It's barred owls now, and it has been for a couple decades.
So are you in favor of them culling some of the barred owls to help the spotted owls?
Absolutely. Yeah, fully behind it. Yeah, 100%. And it's not just for the, I've written some opinion pieces on it and stuff as well. And it's not just for the spotties. I mean, it is marketed as just for the spotties, and I'm sure that's kind of what they have in mind, but it's going to affect a ton more than those. Like our screech owls and stuff are also almost gone. Like legit almost gone. Like Western Washington has no screech owls anymore. Eastern Washington has more screech owls. They're doing okay over there. But Western Washington, they're really, really, really gone. And of course, the bards take a huge toll on our amphibians and prey creatures for the other native owls and stuff. Yeah, it's a huge mess.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like the people I've heard most passionate about it are people that don't just want to shoot birds. It's like that's one side. They're just like, oh, you're shooting a bird, that's bad. And on the other side is the people that actually live on the West Coast. They seem very strongly in favor of it.
Oh yeah. If you ask anyone who's worked with spotted owls for any amount of time, all my friends that are biologists and, have their professions in them, it's like it's clear as day. And it definitely wasn't as clear for me at first, but I've kind of come to realize that there's no other option.
Too bad we can't just catch all the barred owls and put them in like a preserve or something. I
I wish you
mean,
could. Canada's tried that a little bit, I think, but yeah, that's not cheap.
barred owel island or something. It's just
What would
all
probably
barred
happen is
owls.
they would like put them in some other habitat to try to take care of some vermin population or something, and then it would be just another catastrophe.
Yeah, here we go again.
Yeah, exactly.
So, do you have a career path? Like, are you wanting to follow birding as your career path?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I'm far enough from college and stuff that it's not like in the front of my mind yet. But I've definitely considered some sort of ornithology career as the most likely option.
Sweet. We definitely could use some more researchers. There's a lot of interesting stuff to look at, and in my opinion, not enough people out there looking at
It's gonna end up being a barred owl wrangler.
it. I'd be totally fine with that. Put me to work.
He's gonna study the hybrid tufted ducks.
Less okay with that.
I can just
Yes.
picture him out there with like a shotgun, just being like, "I'm here to shoot some owls today."
I do worry about that a little bit. Like, what's going to happen when people actually start removing barred owls from our forests? Like, no, it seems there's a lot of opportunity. It seems like for it to go completely wrong, but I guess we'll see. I don't know. I think there should be a petition to remove all the hybrid tufted ducks as well. I mean, what are they doing any good for? But
I
I don't think that
think
would go
that's a
over too
great
well.
idea.
So, what's your top birding destination you haven't visited yet? Like, if you could go to any place to go birding, what's the top of your list?
Yeah, so kind of what was the top of my list actually was I really wanted to do one of those repositioning cruises from like that go from like California out to Canada to get really far offshore and get like pterodromes and stuff. And I'd really like to do some birding in Mexico, kind of start reaching my way southward. There's a lot of really cool birds in Mexico, so that'd be some stuff that not a lot of people really go for. Like I don't remember what that sparrow is called that's endemic in Mexico. It's like, yeah, I could go see that. That would be really cool. So just like small things like, well, not small things, but I'm more interested in going and targeting a few endemic species somewhere than going to Colombia and seeing 500 lifers. So yeah, I'd like to kind of start reaching my way south.
Yeah, a friend of ours was talking about Puerto Rico as kind of a good way to dip your toes into some of that further south stuff, just because it's a little more manageable than, diving into Costa Rica or Colombia or something like that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the Caribbean for a little while as well, for sure. Yeah, that will hopefully happen sometime in the near future.
Cool. Are you raring to get out of the state this year then?
I wish I had more plans to actually do that, but yeah, I would really like to get out of state zone for sure. Yeah,
Oh,
I
here's a
want to go to
question.
California. Oh yeah.
National big year. Are you going to do one of those ever?
Can't rule it out, but not anytime soon, I would say.
I was going to say that'd be a really
I
convenient way to miss more school.
well, right. I'm not sure my teachers would be quite as impressed by that, but not sure. Just kind of a feeling I have. I have thought about taking a gap year between high school and college and doing something like that, but national big year is a lot more complicated and expensive than a state big year. So I don't really know. I'm not too terribly interested in that. But yeah, I can't rule it out ever.
Fair enough. Did you ever feel burnt out during your state big year?
Surprisingly, not really, no. A lot of people like talk about that happening to them, but I didn't really experience that much. I guess a little bit in the spring migration when I was kind of just racing around after stuff, I got a little bit tired. And a little bit in kind of our late fall window when I was just kind of up on the coast every day looking for Asian vagrants and stuff. Got a little bit tired, but it's not, I didn't really feel burnt out, no. I always wanted to get up and go out the next day.
Cool. I feel like that's something we see. It really is person by person because some are just Man, I didn't want to go see anything, but I felt like I had to because I was doing the big year. And others are just, yeah, every day I was excited to see some rare thing that I'd never seen before. So it really varies.
Yeah, for sure it does. Yeah. Every big year is going to be different.
Yeah. What's kind of the scene like as far as other birders? Do a lot of people bird in Washington?
Yeah, the Washington birding community is pretty tight-knit. There's kind of like a big, there's kind of like a, I don't wanna, well, yeah, it's kind of, there's kind of like almost tiers. Like there's kind of the big group at the top, which I wish I was in, but I'm not, which is kind of like our records committee and eBird reviewers and stuff. And they're a little bit separated from the rest, but not really that much. And then there's kind of just your average birders that are going around Washington and birding. And there's a lot of those. And then there's even more folks that are just kind of on county level stuff, like in our big city, Seattle, which is in King County. There's like 10 or 15 people that seem like their whole life is birding King County, which is awesome because they find some cool stuff and it's really fun to follow along with what they do. So yeah, there's a lot of people birding in Washington.
Cool. I feel like the community is really different in every state. Like ours is pretty tight-knit with there's a lot of people in Milwaukee and a lot of people in Madison. Those are kind of the two big places. But outside of that, some of the smaller counties are probably significantly underbirded. So Ryan, if you want to go do a county big year anywhere, finding one of those like counties nobody's in, you could probably break the record pretty easily.
That's
Yeah, there's
probably
a few
true.
Washington counties like that.
I don't really feel a need to do a county big year anytime soon, but hey.
It's a lot of time to spend in one county.
It is true. And if it's not a very diverse county in terms of the habitat, you're going to get kind of tired of it, I think.
Right, there's a reason those counties aren't birded quite as much as they probably should be.
Yeah, I've always wondered what it'd be like to do a big year in a state that was smaller too, like a Vermont or a Rhode Island.
I have to assume that, yeah, I think it would actually be surprisingly difficult.
I think it'd
Just
be
because,
tricky
yeah.
because a lot of the stuff would come through and then leave fast, I would imagine. I feel like you'd have to be
For
very
sure.
good during migration. And if you didn't do well during migration, I'd think you'd be in trouble. And I would think a lot of time would be spent just watching the ocean and going out in pelagics very regularly.
Depending on which small state you are, yeah, I feel like it would be difficult just because it's like, okay, we have like one marsh at like this corner of the state, so that's going to be your spot for like five things or whatever. I would get worried about stuff like that, like one spot for like 10 species or something. Yeah, where like the whole population's north of you or whatever.
I think Rhode Island's the smallest state. So that'd probably be your best bet. I'd look on eBird, but I can't because it's down. But
Think
I'd be
about
curious to
Hawaii,
see what the
though.
total would be.
Yeah,
How
or
about
like
doing a big year in
how.
Hawaii?
Well, you have the multiple islands you'd have to deal with
Right,
then.
that's what I'm saying. And all the birds are slowly going extinct.
Some not so slowly than others,
That's
yeah.
true. Some are very quickly going extinct.
Right. Good luck getting a Kiki Key for a Hawaii big year.
Well, Ryan Rodriguez has a head start because he got the Kiki.
I was thinking about trying to do that in a couple weeks, but I don't think I have anybody to go with me, unfortunately.
Yes.
Ryan.
So
I kind of want to,
I don't think he
honestly. I
wants to
mean,
go back.
we talked about it.
Yeah, we did
Yeah,
contemplate it.
I'm pretty sure I could. Well, there's probably way too much confidence, but I'm pretty sure I could get the bird. Yeah, but I'm not sure it's the best use of my time. Just because if you miss it, it's like that's a tough trip to miss
Well, I mean,
even
you're in
if you're.
Hawaii, though. I mean, if you miss it, you're like, well, I'm in Hawaii. It's
Well,
not.
right, yeah. I'd be doing it on a very tight schedule, probably. So
That is
like
true.
we have any
It is
time to miss
possible
Hawaii.
that at some point there could be more Kikiki in the wild if they get the
Sure.
breeding program successful.
That would
So
be awesome.
that's kind of what I'm banking on. I'm thinking they're gonna do well and then they'll have a little population at least.
It'd be pretty
Yeah, I
funny if
think
they got
I'm
way
confident
easier
in
to
that.
find.
It's just flooded with the Kikikis. They're like everywhere. But I mean, that'd be a really cool trip. What is one thing you find that's the biggest struggle being a young birder?
Yeah, I actually have a difficult time kind of with like my outside of birding social life just because of birding. Like, all my friends and stuff are like playing football and stuff, and I'm out here looking at birds, which is kind of silly when you think about it. But it's like, yeah, people don't really get it. most people are pretty open to it, which is great, but it doesn't really mean they understand what you're doing. So definitely an issue for me, or and I've heard it's an issue for other young birders as well. Other than that, transportation is tricky, like really tricky. Like, what's holding me back from going to Hawaii? I can't rent my own car, stuff like that.
That's true.
So, and on top of that, I don't have a driver's license, so no reason to even think about it anyways. Yeah, I'd say the transportation and social stuff is the most difficult thing.
Yeah, Ryan and I always say it's kind of goofy because when you're birding, a lot of the people you know are older. So you kind of be like, yeah, my friend Tom got a hip replacement this past weekend and that kind of stuff.
That is
Yeah, I get a
true because
lot of
like
crap for
I'll tell my friends who are my age about stuff that I'm doing in birding with my other friends. I'm like, yeah, Chris, who's retired, of course, went to go do this the other day. It is like a totally different world. It's funny. Also, you're the second younger birder that said that it's kind of lonely to a degree.
that.
So that's definitely something felt by other young birders as well. I
Oh,
think by
yeah,
the time we
I've
got
heard that.
into it, we had some pretty established friends already. So we weren't like starting trying to, make friends through birding, I guess, necessarily. Well, I do remember one time somebody thanked us specifically for being young and being interested in birds, though, in a Chimney Swift presentation. So there's a
Oh,
little
cool.
bit of a unique feeling where people are appreciative just about you being the age that you are and being interested. So that's kind of nice, at least.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that from fellow birders. Yeah, for sure.
They're like,
And
you're the
that
future.
they're always like, oh, those young ears. I need you to come along on my trip because you can hear things that I can't.
They're like,
Right. Yeah.
hey,
Well,
kid,
I
you're
don't
the
know what that
future. You're
is.
going to save the Akiki keys.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to focus on spotted owls first, but we'll see. Yeah, I get a kick out of birding with some of our older birders, but there's a lot of knowledge there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Also, you'll be able to slide right into that retirement, when eventually you hang it up and call it a career, then you're like, I just do birding now, and then you'll be fitting in with all of the old people.
So what do you like to do besides birding? Do you have any like sports hobbies or just other things you enjoy doing?
Not
Yeah,
football.
definitely. I row for a sport, and I've done that for a while now. And that's really interesting. I feel like the other rowers on my team get a little annoyed sometimes since I'm kind of half rowing, half birding whenever we're out on the water. Like, you think I'm just gonna ignore that rhinoceros auklet right there? Not really. But I do that, which is really nice. Sucks up a lot of time though. Other like natural history stuff that I do is I'm really into moths. So I catch a lot of moths here and I spread them, and I collect them and I photograph them. I put them on iNaturalist and all that. That's really been fun. The moth community, if you thought the birding community was tight knit, the moth community is like everybody knows everyone. It's small. So that's been really, really fun, and they've been really accepting and kind to me. So I've been enjoying that a lot. I've been doing that for a few years now, and moth identification is a huge pain. So that's been definitely a challenge. I mean, it pales in comparison to birds.
I feel like a significant amount of people I know who are birders have gotten into mothing, which is it's not the intuitive thing of like, you like birds, now go look at moths, but it seems like there is some connection there.
They have wings and you identify them. I mean, what is there to be different about it?
I guess
Exactly.
so.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the
I've
world of insects is that you
definitely confused
could.
moths for hummingbirds before.
Oh, wait, what
It
was
does
that?
happen, yeah.
Well, I was going to say I've confused moths for hummingbirds
Oh,
before, too.
yeah, for
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah,
Hummingbird moths,
yeah.
especially. That's the best of both worlds.
Right.
I was going to say you could find, super rare species of
Yeah.
moths and other insects that no one even knows about. So it's like the Wild West of animal identification.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got to help out in a study that was being done by Colorado State University Professor Chuck Harp a little while ago. I got to send him some specimens from genus Orthosia and Azura here in Washington that I collected. I sent him a few hundred specimens of those moths. He was doing some DNA work on them. And through that study, I think he found one or two new species in like Utah or something like that. Like, there's not a lot of fields where new species are being discovered. And mothing is one of them, and that's really cool. That's really fascinating to me. Like, you could just go set your moth trap up somewhere in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it'd probably have to be pretty remote these days, but you could do that and you could potentially catch a new species that nobody's seen before. And that is really interesting.
Yeah.
Out in Arizona, we were at the Patton Center for Hummingbirds, and there was a black witch moth hanging out on like the overhang there. And
Oh, very cool.
one of the dudes who was birding was more excited about that than any of the birds. He's like, "Oh my gosh, it's a black witch moth." It was really cool.
Yeah, I can't. I think I might have seen one of those in Arizona. I can't quite remember. Yeah, that's awesome.
It's a pretty cool name for an animal too, a black witch moth.
Oh yeah, moth names are way better than bird names by a long
I think
shot.
dragonfly names take the cake, though.
Essentially, yeah.
Hummingbirds have some pretty cool names, though.
They do, yeah. The most common moth that I catch at my house is called speckled green fruit worm. It's a pretty high quality name.
Dragonflies, though, are like emerald pond death monster and things like that. So, I mean.
Yeah, fair enough. If I ever discover a new dragonfly, which is very highly unlikely, I'm naming it an emerald pond death monster. That's a good one.
I like it.
Very good. So I think during the eBird outage, there's like for whenever people are listening to this, there's a eBird's down for a couple days for maintenance. I feel like it's really highlighted people's eBird addictions because we've been talking to a couple of people like, well, I don't know what I'm gonna do now because eBird's down. Like it's like an addiction to them. Like I can't get my fix of looking at bird data.
Oh yeah, me too, for sure. Yeah, I've been suffering. I can't remember what it was, but I wanted to pull up a range map for something today, and I was really unhappy when it didn't work. What do you mean I can't see the records for whatever that was and whatever that place? I don't remember. I do it so much every day. It's, take it for granted, but here we are.
Yeah, we're pretty spoiled to live in a time where we can just look up that data. Because we were saying, can
Oh, for
you
sure.
imagine if when rarities there was no way to communicate, and we just like, yeah, I heard through three people there was this rare bird over there, not knowing at all if it was legit or not, and just having to go look for it.
I mean, look at how obsessed Liam is. He's got an eBird hat that he's bringing to the party, so he's clearly trying to make up for the fact he can't look at the data any way possible.
I get the
I
vibe he
wanted to
100%
Google.
wants to be an eBird reviewer one day.
Me?
Yeah.
I'd be pretty happy with that. Yeah, I've asked a few times and been very, very politely shot down.
Just need to go to a place where there's no reviewer.
I will say Washington needs more reviewers because, like, one of our reviewers like sent me a screenshot of the review queue at some point, and it was like 2,000 observations long that needed reviewing. Like, come on, guys.
You know who could
Yeah,
help him with that?
need to get some more people. What was that?
You could.
That's what I was thinking. Not quite. We'll see. Sometime soon, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool. Ryan, do you have anything else to
Nope, I'm excited to go to Washington and find pygmy owls, though.
add? That's true. We were promised.
And that one spotted owl on a sheer cliff, so.
I don't know if I can promise that. Well, I don't even know if it's still alive this year, but yeah.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, you can check out Liam's Instagram, Liam Hutchison Wildlife. Got some cool pictures on there with the new R5. And thanks to everyone for watching this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.